First, the productivity of workers in the United States has gone up since the 1970s, but pay and benefits haven't kept up. Our next guest says that's because of a long-term shift in the balance of power between workers and employers, and he says the same trends have made it harder for employees to advocate for their own safety during the COVID-19 outbreak. Josh Idelson is a labor reporter for Bloomberg News and Businessweek. He wrote the piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, for Bloomberg News. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you spell out that that divergence you talk about in your article, first of all? Productivity going up per worker in the United States, while wages and benefits not.
Sure. There's been an acrimonious divorce between workers' productivity and their pay, which used to rise largely in conjunction with each other. Since the 70s, productivity has continued going up. Workers have been creating more and more wealth, but their pay has, in comparison, been more stagnant. And that's particularly true in some of the fastest growing industries in the U.S., that we've seen real wages not budging much. And in fact, if you're a minimum wage worker, then the minimum wage you're receiving is worth a lot less than it used to be.
Concerns in COVID-19. What kind of things did you see when you looked at American workplaces?
I've talked in recent months to workers in warehouses, in tech, in farm work, in domestic work, in all sorts of industries. And Americans are expressing and noticing things that many find disturbing. And the coronavirus really has laid bare issues that didn't begin with the pandemic, but that have been turbocharged or exposed by it. So people have been noticing that we have so-called essential food workers who don't get paid sick days. We have people from warehouses to hospitals who speak up about safety issues and then get terminated. And these are things that are particularly American in the way they happen, because the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to the lack of certain guaranteed protections, like being able to miss a shift and get paid if you're sick, and also when it comes to the lack of robust protection for workers who try to band together to do something about those working conditions.
We're talking to Josh Idelson, labor reporter for Bloomberg News, about his latest piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced. Josh, both of those trends, the pay not keeping up with productivity, the about workplace conditions, you tie to a longer term trend, even a decline in labor, in unions in the United States. Take us back to how that got eroded over the decades.
That's right. So in 1935, 85 years ago this past weekend, President Roosevelt signed into law the National Labor Relations Act, a law that commits the U.S. government not just to allow or to protect, but to promote rights like collective bargaining. It's a law that promises workers it should be up to them whether they want to act together, protests, through negotiations, to collectively change their working conditions. And it's a law that's explicitly supposed to rebalance the balance of power between workers and managers and executives. Now, what has happened is not what the law promised. The law has failed. And we see now workers who take action collectively lack robust protection from retaliation. And the unionized share of the workforce has plummeted. It has plummeted for decades. Part of the reason is that some workers were excluded from the very beginning in the sexist and racist exclusions of workers like farm workers and domestic workers. Part of the reason is that the remedy that is available to workers when the law is not followed is weak. The National Labor Relations Act only offers the legal recourse of going through an agency called the National Labor Relations Board, where companies, if they fire somebody for organizing with their coworkers, generally don't have to fear anything worse than someday, eventually, maybe years later, having to bring that person back, pay them some back pay with no liability for executives, no punitive damages, and post a notice saying that they won't do it again. Workers are also supposed to be able to take matters into their own hands by putting pressure on their employer through tactics like strikes. But a series of legislative and judicial changes have made those strikes very risky and less effective. In fact, soon after the National Labor Relations Act became law, just a few years later, we saw the first of a series of very consequential rulings saying that even though the law restricts companies from firing people in retaliation for striking, it doesn't stop companies from so-called permanent replacement of strikers. And if you're the one who just lost your job, whether it was a firing or a permanent replacement is not a distinction that's going to give you a lot of comfort.
You also write about something, a big business called Labor Relations Consulting. Can you talk about what is involved in that?
Yes, we have revealed in this story what federal filings from the past couple decades show about companies from Pepsi to PetSmart. Almost any big company you can think of seems to be on the list of clients of labor relations consultants. These are companies that are brought in to try to persuade workers against unionizing or keep tabs on workers during disputes. And it's become a mammoth industry. Companies take full advantage of the opportunities the law gives them to deter workers from organizing. That can include legally holding mandatory meetings that workers have to attend in which they can be told all kinds of ominous so-called predictions about the bad things that could happen if they unionize. Companies also, if they violate the law, for example, by firing or threatening people for organizing, don't have to fear the kinds of penalties that they might under other areas of law other than labor relations. And we've seen companies sprout up as these consultants to help companies take full advantage of each of these gaps, each of these opportunities that courts and legislators have created for companies to use the coercive power of being the boss to stop people from taking collective action.
Another angle you cover in your piece is OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, when it comes to handling complaints about worker safety, particularly in this era of COVID. It sounds like they're kind of overwhelmed now.
There has been a surge of complaints made to OSHA and its state equivalents, over 20,000 complaints. Workers have spoken up about things like allegations of healthcare establishments that are not just failing to provide, but actually restricting workers from using protective equipment. And OSHA has so far announced only one citation against a company related to the coronavirus. OSHA said in April it would generally ask companies to investigate themselves rather than sending in inspectors. And so workers have felt tremendous concern and disappointment in many cases with the lack of more forceful action, which people blame in part on the lack of resources of the agency, which entered this year with the fewest inspectors it's had in decades.
We're talking to Josh Idelson, reporter covering labor for Bloomberg News and Business Week. We're talking about his story, How the American Worker Got Fleeced. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the decline of union power has hurt American workers, or do you think it's a good trend? Has your workplace done enough to protect against the spread of COVID-19? Would you feel safe raising concerns about safety among your coworkers or even your bosses? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. I apologize. Looks like we had some connection problems with our audio. We are back, I believe. Josh Idelson with us from Bloomberg News. He wrote the piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, for Bloomberg News. Josh, before the break and the little extra intermission there, you were starting to talk about pushback, I think, efforts to turn the pendulum in the other direction on behalf of labor. What kind of things are you seeing?
So there have been efforts for as long as workers have been trying to organize, companies have been trying to stop them through everything from industrial spies to violent police repression to mass firings. And as long as labor has been on the decline, workers have been trying to find ways to turn it around. And some of the things we've seen in recent years that have made headway include strikes by teachers who tied their cause to the cause of their community and defied mayors, governors, in some cases their own union leaders, and ended up extracting significant gains. We've seen so-called comprehensive campaigns where, rather than going through the labor board, unions have brought a combination of workplace activism, strikes, political, media, legislative, even zoning pressure, attacks on a brand to eventually squeeze a company until it agrees to a process where workers can unionize. We've seen pressure on states and cities to do things they can to boost both labor standards and some workers' ability to organize, though the federal labor law itself restricts how much they can do that. And during the pandemic, we've seen waves of strikes and walkouts by workers that have served to put a harsh public spotlight on the end of the bargain that these so-called essential workers are getting as they take on risk to keep certain services going. We've seen places from warehouses to tech to meatpacking to healthcare become sites of protests that have drawn attention. And we've also seen new precedents created during the pandemic, like the very limited conditional form of sick leave offered by Congress, or conditional protections for workers to be whistleblowers in certain cities that are being proposed, that raise questions about why broader protections are not part of the fabric of what it means to go to work in the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Menominee. Kevin, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Oop.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
Okay.
Yeah, Kevin, you're on the air. What did you want to bring up?
Okay, I was fired in early May, and I'm pretty sure it was because I pointed out deficiencies in the company's token COVID-19 actions. And I would urge anyone who is in this similar situation to use caution and record everything that you do on your phone if you have a conversation with someone about this kind of stuff. For myself, I haven't gotten any unemployment compensation. And of course, there's a big backlog there. So anyway, that's all I have.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. Josh, what do you think of what Kevin had to say?
This is the kind of disturbing allegation that we're hearing from workers all over the country. And a part of what it reflects is what it's like to work under so-called at-will employment in the United States, where the presumption is a company doesn't need any good reason to fire you. They can fire you for almost any reason. And if you're fired for one of the few reasons that's illegal, such as for taking collective action with your coworkers around work conditions, then it can be very difficult to prove that that's what's happened. And that fear of retaliation silences people individually and collectively. And workers who I've talked to in all sorts of industries that some people think are radically alien to each other, have expressed similar concerns that decisions get made without full input, let alone veto, from the workers that will be most affected. And workers are constrained in their ability to address it because they worry about losing their jobs. And these are stories that I'm always interested in hearing about, whatever kind of work you're doing. And so please, anyone, reach out to me.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kevin. Dan joins us now in Dane County. Dan, hello.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I heard a topic about COVID-19 and the pandemic and how it's affected workers all across the country. And I'm a truck driver myself, and I deliver freight all across the Midwest and all across the country sometimes. And what I've noticed from a lot of the warehouses that was mentioned before and the workers within, but I'm sort of a kind of a tangent to those businesses because I go there maybe once or twice a week, and some places I'll only be there one time and I won't be there again. Now, my concern with these places is, since the pandemic and since the lockdowns, they have restricted access for us truck drivers into their facility. So they want minimum contact with us. Now, what that entails is oftentimes they won't allow us to use their facilities, to use their restrooms, to wash our hands, to use a sink with water and soap to actually wash our hands. So what they do oftentimes is they might replace our access to the restrooms with porta potties. And these porta potties won't have any water or soap that we can wash our hands with after we use it. They're usually completely filthy because there's one porta potty, and all of the truck drivers who go there throughout the weeks or the months that this has been going on have been using the same one, and it's absolutely unsanitary and unusable sometimes. And they'll put a hand sanitizer there as a replacement for a sink and soap, which is not a good replacement. A hand sanitizer does not do the same job as washing your hands with soap and water. And a lot of times, even those hand sanitizer dispensers will be empty. So we're essential workers. Those businesses, those warehouses depend on us to bring them the material they need for them to conduct their business. But as the people who bring them that valuable service, we're basically ignored and expected to fend for ourselves when it comes to these essential needs. So I'm not sure what exactly
Dan,
can be done about that.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I hadn't even thought about that from the perspective of truck drivers, Josh. In our last couple of minutes, what do you think?
I think this is the kind of issue that a lot of workers in different industries are voicing. And part of what Dan's experience reflects is many workers in the U.S. are creating wealth for and being subject to rules from a company that on paper doesn't employ them. This so-called fissured workplace, in which the employer-employee relationship that our New Deal laws are based around, is not the situation that workers have found themselves shoved into. And so that's something that further frays the lines of accountability in workers trying to seize a measure of dignity and compensation on the job. And this is a trend that has been going on for a long time, including in laws like Taft-Hartley that took more workers and pushed them out of the bounds of labor law protection.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Josh, thanks for bearing with the technical troubles there. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. And please, anyone, reach out, JEIDELSON@Bloomberg.net.
Josh Idelson is a labor reporter for Bloomberg News and Business Week covering the American workplace. We've got his piece, How the American Worker Got Fleeced, up at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, the author of a new graphic novel shares the story of his life with OCD. We'll meet the author of Everything Is an Emergency. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.